101 Detectives by Ivan Vladislavich. Table of Contents. The Fugu Eaters. Surveillance and the Bitter Smoke of the Past Hairshirt. Myth, Memory, and the Allergic Reaction to History. 101 Detectives. The Ordinary and the Undercover Exit Strategy. The Corporate Storyteller and the Art of Falling the Reading. Translation is Resurrection the Trunks. A Complete History of Pointless Paper. Additional Sketches. Art, Industry, and Morning Conclusion. The Echoing Solitudes. Ivan Vladislavich's 101 Detectives is a sophisticated collection of short stories that delves into the intricacies of professional observation, the weight of personal and collective history, and the absurdities of modern corporate and industrial life. The narrative often centers on characters who are detectives, in a literal or metaphorical sense, watchers, auditors, storytellers, and archivists who navigate a world defined by surveillance, displacement, and the pointless paper of human existence. The Fugu Eaters, Surveillance and the Bitter Smoke of the Past. The collection opens with a story featuring two detectives, Klopper and Bate, who are engaged in a long-term surveillance operation from a tinted window hotel room. The narrative is characterized by a stark contrast between the mundane physical discomforts of the present and the haunting memories of a more sinister past. Bate is recovering from a traumatic dental experience. His mouth is a wounded landscape of empty sockets where his wisdom teeth were recently splintered out by a dentist he views as a sadist. To pass the time, he reads a Reader's Digest article about the fugu fish, a Japanese delicacy whose gonads contain tetrodotoxin, a poison 27 times more deadly than a green mamba. The article details the arduously trained chefs required to prepare the fish and the philosophy of the fugu eaters, which suggests that both eating and not eating the fish is stupid. Klopper, meanwhile, is the senior observer, sitting the wrong way round on a chair at the window, his chin propped on his wrist. He is obsessed with professional discipline, insisting that they leave not a crumb behind in the room. However, his mind frequently drifts back to a pivotal event from their past, a fire initiated by their captain. Klopper recalls transporting plastic-wrapped evidence on the back of a baki to a remote farm. Instead of burying the files as planned, the captain decided to burn them, declaring that what goes up in smoke is gone for good. As the fire raged by a dam, the captain revealed his profound loneliness. His wife had left him for a Sandton desk jockey, leaving him to live on takeaways. In the heart of the fire, the detectives watched as layers of blackened leaves came away from the spines of dockets and logbooks, and new white pages unfolded, revealing recognizable handwriting even in the cinders. The smoke, compounded of leather and ink and sealing wax, made Klopper acutely aware of the taste of blood on his own tongue, a sensory bridge between the destruction of the evidence and the meat they were brawing. Hairshirt, Myth, Memory, and the Allergic Reaction to History. In Hairshirt, a young South African man living in San Diego recounts a road trip with his girlfriend, Mel, to her parents' home in Oklahoma City. The narrator is a man without a visa or prospects, existing in a precarious state and constructing a fantasy of his future to impress Mel's parents, Mike and Hedda Liebman. The story shifts into a surreal, mythic register when Mel and the narrator drive into the Arkansas mountains to visit Uncle Collie. Collie is the black sheep of the family, a man whose entire body is covered in thick hair. In his youth, he had been displayed in freak shows as a wolfman or ape man. The narrator's encounter with Collie is defined by a vision that transcends psychology and leans into a medieval bestiary. Through the slats of a blind, the narrator observes Mel bathing Collie in a metal tub behind his ramshackle cabin. He describes Collie as a shaggy hound, or a dog-headed man, who moans with painful pleasure as Mel scrubs foam into his fur with a long-handled brush. When Collie stands, the narrator sees him as the head of a man on the body of a beast. As a parting gift, Collie gives the narrator a red flannel shirt that smells of bacon grease and sweat and is filled with hard red earth from nesting insects. Although the narrator discards the shirt on the way home, its impact persists. The climax occurs at a Shabbos dinner. At the Liebman's house, attended by Mel's uncle, Morris, a psychologist with an ambiguous bow tie and a puffy hand, Morris interrogates the narrator about South Africa, claiming he despises apartheid, but also mocking the narrator's master race background. During the meal, as Morris discusses the wasteful excesses of modern healers and diseases of the skin like urticaria and suppurating boils, the narrator suffers a violent allergic reaction. His skin crawled, his belly was covered with red spots, and his neck puffed out, like a bullfrog's. Morris takes charge, administering a tranquilizer and observing that the skin never lies, and that one never knows what will come to the surface. 0.101 Detectives. The Ordinary and the Undercover. The title story follows Joseph Blumenfeld, a detective who travels to a convention titled 101 Detectives, Sub-Saharan Africa. Blumenfeld is a man in a constant state of undercover anxiety, unsure whether his special quality is his own ordinariness. Upon arriving at his hotel, he is greeted by a personalized message on the TV screen. Sonny Banani welcomes Mr. Joseph Blumenfeld. The sight of his own name, his undercover name in red letters, causes a cold fist to clench in his gut, making him feel like an imposter. He recalls the advice of his mentor, Long John DeLange, who taught him that all detectives feel like charlatans. Blumenfeld spends much of the story obsessing over the details of his environment and his own physical and mental state. He takes a toxicity test from a leaflet given to him by a man at the airport, ticking boxes that confirm he feels fatigued for no apparent reason, wooden, and less alert. He examines his room with clinical suspicion, noting a ballpoint pen on the dresser, and the lion rampant crest on the toweling dressing gown. His narrative is a meditation on the different types of detectives, the obsessive-compulsive Jews, the guilt-ridden Catholics, the Lutheran hemophiliacs, and the sodden colleagues who bond over gin and tonic. He reflects on the pointless rigmarole of introduction at conventions where everyone is undercover and the modern slob detectives who wear Iron Maiden t-shirts and thick lip trainers. Eventually, Blumenfeld suspects the entire convention is an elaborate sting to do away with me, as he recognizes none of the names on the organizing committee. The story ends with him paralyzed by indecision, trapped between his need for an exit strategy and his habitual waiting. Exit strategy, the corporate storyteller and the art of falling. Exit strategy introduces a corporate storyteller who works on the 11th floor of a high-tech office building. Her job is to provide parables and fresh and leafy input for board meetings and Green Day events. She feels gnarled as an old vine and is preoccupied with the poles of her narrative system, up and down, in and out, big and small. The central motif of her story is the recitation pod, a device she must thrust her head into to speak her truth. The pod smells of ammonia, but emits a pleasant, glandular fragrance of cinnamon, cloves, and caramelized sugar to encourage output. Inside the pod, the space feels endless and laden with dark shades, but the storyteller feels stifled, her jaw numb and immobile. Her narrative arc involves two main threads. The basement archive. She applies for a higher office but is instead shown a room in the basement, the third level of the parking garage. This room was the office of the original corporate storyteller. It is a small, busy room, filled with the corporate fictions, thousands of books and paper records that have been outsourced and plugged from the digital system. The sight of these unrestricted paper memories overwhelms her, making her heart soar, despite the lack of a window. The climber. From her window, she witnesses a bargain basement superhero climbing the glass facade of the building. He is the human fly, sheathed in a climbing suit with pectorals and biceps screen printed on the fabric. She watches as he reaches the most dangerous part, the 21st floor, where the channels in the window frames end and he must find an exit strategy. The story concludes with the storyteller pressing her own left hand against a powdery impression of a palm left by the climber on the glass. This consoling symmetry lifts her feet from the floor, making her feel as if she is rising, going up, finally embracing an exit strategy of her own. The reading, translation is Resurrection. The reading is set in a literature house in Germany, where a Ugandan writer, Maryam Akello, is reading from her book, Sugar. The audience listens to her soft-grained monotone, Acholi voice, though most do not understand the language. Her translator, Hans Gunther Bash, sits on the podium, preoccupied by his own process and his recent meeting with Akello in his kitchen. Akello's reading style is described as the sewing machine style. A blank monotone that allows the listener to apply their own emphases and tense. The content of her book is harrowing. It details her and her sister Anya's abduction by the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA. Bash recalls his struggle to translate a specific line where Akello describes her sister's murder. Akello had written in the margin of the manuscript the word translated to describe Anya's death, as if death itself were a language. The passage Bash eventually reads describes the LRA commander killing Anya with a panga because she slipped on the shale and falls, breaking a box of bullets. The survivors are forced to step on this thing that was Anya as a lesson. As Bash reaches the final lines of the translation, "I have translated you from the dead," he has a psychological breakdown. He is overcome by a sob that rings through the loudspeakers. His face began to crumble as he wept as if he would never stop. The audience is left in a state of consternation, while Akello herself remains composed D and remote. The trunks, a complete history of pointless paper. The final significant narrative in the collection involves a writer who inherits the trunks of Claude and his father Bertie. The trunks had been in storage in Cape Town for nearly half a century after the two arrived from Europe after World War II. The writer spends years cataloging the contents. The trunks. There are four of them, ranging from an enormous traveling chest, the size of a coffin, to a smaller metal trunk, and a wooden chest with leather trim. The contents. The writer finds 215 books, ranging from a harem-scarem schoolgirl to anti-Semitic diatribes. The books are marked by cigarette burns, food stains, and moth wanes. There are also Bertie's cutthroat razors, 12 pairs of glasses, and bundles of letters in coffee-colored envelopes. The pointless paper. The writer becomes overwhelmed by the haze of irretrievable significance in these objects. He realizes that the trunks are a prophecy of the pointless end that awaits all those who set too much store by the written word. The writer moves the trunks from a self-storage depot to his own guest suite. After a thief breaks into the guest suite and ransacks the trunks, without finding anything of value, the writer decides to dismember the collection. He donates the books to an SPCA shop and has the Salvation Army take the empty trunks and papers away in a lorry. He concludes that the restless passage of Claude and Bertie's lives has been irrecoverably lost, a realization that brings tears to his eyes. Additional sketches, art, industry, and Morning Mountain landscape. A CEO, H.K. Koza, writes to a curator regarding a Pierre Neef painting discovered in a storeroom on the 19th floor. He defends the painting against academic critiques that call it the historic ist, arguing that it commands attention and provides a proprietorial gaze that aligns with corporate culture. Lullaby. A businessman in Mauritius observes a woman, Martha, and her son, Eki, who share an intense, unnormal affection. After the businessman witnesses an impression of Eki's ear on Martha's shoulder after a nap, the story ends in tragedy. Eki drowns during a catamaran trip when he is caught in a tangle of lines under the boat. Industrial theater. A narrator attends a lavish launch for the new Ford Kafka, an event where the point is not character but action, and the climax is all that matters. The launch features a spectacle of sacrificial victims on rising columns and an actor playing Kafka in a trench coat and broad-brimmed hat, dead letters. A photographer, Neville Lister, creates a project based on a cache of dead letters, mail that was never delivered because the addresses were incomplete. The letters include a teacher's concern about a student in South Africa, dressed as a black man, in 1978, and a man's anxiety about nameless thing S, buried in his backyard in Langsburg. Conclusion: The Echoing Solitudes. Vladislavic's collection is a haunting exploration of the human desire to document and the failure to truly know. Whether it is the detectives watching a street, the corporate storyteller searching for a parable, or the archivist cataloging a stranger's life, the characters are all searching for a firm and true foundation that is constantly being undermined by the clutter and pointless paper of their own histories. The dream count of these detectives is a record of loss, surveillance, and the serrated scars of the past. This summary is for educational purposes only.